No.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't accidentally woken up in 2016 by mistake. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Heavens, it is rather hot here in the Sahara, but the view of those beautiful sand dunes stretching into the distance is worth it. Miles of unbroken sandy wilderness, and such clean air. Do come and sit in the shade of the gazebo so you don't get sunstroke. There's plenty of room.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived, Dr. Francesca Haig.
I'm sorry, Latimer, I didn't quite catch that. Doctor who?
Certainly not, ma'am. Never again. I said Dr. Francesca Haig.
Oh, splendid. Let's see her calling card. Dr. Francesca Haig, novelist, poet, academic, prolific laugher at own jokes.
I hope for her sake that she is very witty.
I like the motif of the teetering pile of books. Show her over, Latimer. For those of you who don't know, Francesca Haig's poetry and prose have won various prizes in both Australia and the UK. Her debut novel, The Fire Sermon, will soon be published by Harper Voyager in the UK and Simon & Schuster in the United States.
Dr. Francesca Haig, ma'am.
Hello, Francesca. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Thank you. Very grateful for the shade out of this desert heat.
It's very, very warm, isn't it? The heat doesn't bother you too much, does it?
Well, I was expecting it to be warm in the Sahara. This is possibly even hotter than I'd anticipated.
Yes, but it's a dry heat.
That's right. No, it's lovely, really, and lovely to see you.
And you as well. Would you care for some tea?
Yes, please.
And how do you take your tea?
No sugar and an absurd amount of milk, please.
Oh, that is actually the correct way.
Excellent.
I shouldn't say something so controversial, should I? But that's exactly how I take my tea. Marvellous. And I was wondering if you would like some Manchester pudding.
I don't know what Manchester pudding is, so I'm not sure if this is a trick question. Edible, then I almost definitely want it.
Well, yes, this is something I discovered over the Christmas holidays, actually, which I'm quite excited about. It's a kind of really, really rich custard, which is bulked out with breadcrumbs, so it's like really, really stodgy. And then it's baked, and then you take them out of the oven and you put raspberry jam in, and then you make a meringue over the top as a lid over it.
This is like being in the historical factual segment in the middle of Great British Bake Off.
I don't watch it, but I have heard of...
Well, Hollywood is going to wander in from stage left at any minute with his terrifying grin.
No, I don't think they're filming in the desert at the moment, so I think we'll be okay.
Right, that's a peril I probably couldn't have handled.
No, I don't think I could have either, because I haven't got enough for everybody. It would be so horrendously embarrassing if the entire TV show film crew turned up and there wasn't enough tea. Can you imagine?
The horror.
So, Manchester pudding all round.
Yes, please.
And don't mind that little tent over there. That's for the chickens, because we don't want them to get heat stroke, poor darlings.
Oh, I thought that was where you were keeping Latimer these days.
Yes, he ducks in there when we don't immediately need him. He doesn't seem to like the sun too much either. Now, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you today. What have you decided to bring with you?
I have bought my treasured Penguin Books P.G. Wodehouse mug, which has the beautiful orange and white striped penguin cover of My Man Jeeves by P.G. Wodehouse.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, Wodehouse is a sort of necessary tonic for me because I write post-apocalyptic novels and pretty depressing poetry. When I have my academic hat on, my specialism is Holocaust literature. So I'm surrounded by depressing things, and P.G. Wodehouse is my sort of life raft. So nothing like a dose of Wodehouse before bed after a day immersed in the Holocaust and various apocalypses.
Heavens! Yes, indeed. In fact, would you like your second cup of tea in your special mug?
If that's not rude, that would be a real treat. Thank you.
That's not rude at all. It's a Woodhouse mug. That's perfectly acceptable. So I was going to ask, because there's academic on your calling card, which flavour of academia you're in, but you study Holocaust literature?
Well, yeah, I taught when I was still working in academia. At the moment, I've stepped back to write full time. I lectured in creative writing and English literature, but my research specialism was Holocaust literature.
Wow. So is this literature written by people who have survived it or inspired by? Or
Both, really. I would say that my particular specialism is not really survivor memoirs or even survivor literature, but purely fictional accounts, which is an odd thing in a way. I mean, I was talking to a historian who works in the same field of Holocaust studies, and he said, why not just study the thing itself? Why study the representation of the thing? He was baffled, you know, about how I could find it more interesting to look at mediated representations of the event rather than throwing myself into history and reading about the event itself. But to me, it was those complicated steps in between the event and the literature that make it so fascinating. It's how do people represent or fail to represent something that is real, people who perhaps most interestingly to me weren't there themselves. It's those very murky areas that I find most fascinating rather than the factual event itself, which is fascinating too in a very grisly way, but it's the process of artistic representation that interests me the most.
I'm totally with you on that, actually. I think the way that you can observe the human mind kind of processing these horrific events and how that kind of is manifested in art is endlessly fascinating.
That's right. The challenges that it throws up to art and also, I suppose, ethically and morally.
Mm.
But also I wonder if it's a sort of self-preservation instinct, but I suspect that if I were knee-deep every day in research concerning the event itself, it would probably require more than even P.G. Woodhouse could provide in terms of cheering up.
Yes, indeed. And I find it interesting that you write post-apocalyptic books, because I've done the same in the past and I am a huge fan of the genre. And to me, you can see so many kind of psychological scars on a global scale and on a micro scale that are kind of expressed in post-apocalyptic fiction. So I wonder if there's a parallel between what you choose to study there and also what you write creatively. Do you think that's too much of a leap?
No, I don't think it's a leap at all, although it's not a connection that I was aware of at the time when I sat down to write this novel, or indeed when the idea came to me. But afterwards I sort of thought, gosh, that's roaringly obvious. I spend my working days thinking about Holocaust literature, and I've produced a novel that looks at the aftermath of a global apocalypse. But I've actually, you know, again, with my rather less exciting, perhaps, to your listeners, but with my academic hat on, I've recently published a chapter in a book which is all about the fact that when people talk about post-apocalyptic novels, everyone tends to talk about a nuclear holocaust, which is indeed the origin of the apocalypse in The Fire Sermon, my novel. But I think there's actually a lot of references and perhaps more echoes and impressions made by the Holocaust, not in the sense of nuclear holocaust, but in the sense of the destruction of European Jewry in World War II. I think that particular catastrophe has actually leaked into post-apocalyptic literature in a way that is less obvious than the nuclear stuff, and that actually has a very strong presence in a lot of those post-apocalyptic novels that's perhaps gone a bit under-recognised.
That's interesting, because I think that the Cold War had a massive impact on the stuff that was being kind of written, because it seems to go cyclically. Like, you have a whole load of post-apocalyptic stuff in the 50s and then in the 80s, yeah, and then we have another one that started kind of, you know, around 2010-ish.
Yes.
And it's like every generation has to go through this kind of process of working through all of this really awful stuff.
And that's right, yeah. I mean, I think you're quite right that it is a generational coming to terms with our worst imagining.
Mm.
But what's interested me when I've been looking at the sort of echoes of the Holocaust in post-apocalyptic literature is the way in which, because it's the preeminent tragedy in the Western imagination of the 20th century, and there's a whole school of debate about whether that should be the case, you know, all the Eurocentric white privileging of some tragedies and genocides over others. But it is that, rightly or wrongly, and I think that it therefore has shaped our imaginings of worst-case scenarios, whether we're aware of it or not. It's kind of inflected the apocalyptic imagination to such a strong extent.
And the dystopian aspects of it as well, but, you know, how many books there are about kind of divided societies and persecution of groups of people. And
absolutely. And I think in dystopian literature rather than post-apocalyptic literature, people have been very quick to recognise representations of the Nazi state. That hasn't gone unrecognised. It's just that I was interested in this little pocket where the Holocaust seemed to have not perhaps been recognised as an influence in post-apocalyptic literature. But you're right. I mean, the problem is, of course, that Nazi Germany replicated our worst fears so perfectly that, of course, when we're imagining dystopian states, we have a template already created for us there in the most horrible way.
It's just a real shame that a lot of people around today involved in the media aren't going, oh my goodness, there are so many things which are very similar to just before Nazi Germany going on.
I know, it's beyond depressing, isn't it?
It really is. My goodness, this is such a serious conversation. Let's have some more tea and some more pudding.
That's right, thank you.
Yes, from puddings to awful, awful effects of evil. Not a leap that I anticipated this morning, I must admit. Now, let's move away from such things. I think there is very definitely a very important place for such things, but there's also very much a place for silliness and lightness. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about on the journey from one to the other is about stuff going on at the moment where everyone is saying, hey, we're eligible for these awards. I was wondering if there is anything that you've read or consumed over the last year that you fear may be overlooked in all of the clamour of people saying, hey, nominate this for this award.
Oh, gosh. Do you know, I'm not sure that I'm likely to come up with any unexpected gems because my reading has been a bit constrained this year by the arrival of the Sun and Air. So those few books that I have managed to read are the ones that have been sort of pressed onto me by friends raving about them, the ones that have already received lots of attention, books that I've really enjoyed, like Jessie Burton's The Miniaturist. But Jessie has so many awards now that we could hardly accuse her of being ignored. And some of the books that I've read this year, as is always the case, are ones that I've been meaning to read for ages and aren't new, so therefore would have been eligible for awards years ago. The book that really knocked my socks off this year was Sarah Waters' The Night Watch, which is, you know, years old, but I just thought it was magnificent.
I feel your pain. It's a bit of a cultural desert sometimes, parenthood, when you can't go to the cinema and you can't go and get things, or you don't have enough energy to go and find new books.
No, I mean, I read new books all the time, but unfortunately they're 10 pages long and feature a disproportionate number of lions and tigers. I feel like those animals are really overrepresented in children's literature, and my son's going to grow up and sort of feel ripped off that suburban London isn't teeming with lions and elephants and crocodiles.
I'm disappointed by this on a daily basis, actually.
Aren't we all?
So, hypothetically, If you could go back in time and erase the existence of one particular animal, which one would it be and why? And this is, of course, assuming that it doesn't lead to a catastrophic collapse of our current day ecosystem or accidentally make us not evolve the way we are. This is purely hypothetical.
I think we're doing a good enough job of organising a catastrophic collapse of our ecosystem.
Yeah.
My hypothetical past assistance. I think it would have to be the giraffe. There was one particular giraffe toy that my son was fascinated with, and I spent many hours sitting on the rug shaking this toy giraffe, and it just threw up a very stark contrast between the me who used to stride into lecture theatres and have engaging conversations with students and colleagues, and the me that now sat in my pajamas on the floor waving a toy giraffe ad nauseum. So I think that giraffe in particular can go to hell as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, giraffes as well are really just quite bizarre. When you stop and actually look at them, it's like somebody was doing one of those like flip books where you draw the head and then you draw the middle bit and then you draw the rest, and nobody saw the other things that were drawn.
I do know what you mean, yeah. My issue with the giraffe is not primarily visual. It's auditory. It doesn't make a sound. And I think for an animal that's represented so heavily in children's books, You need to have a sound. If anyone can tell me, please, if I can beseech your listeners to tell me what noise does a giraffe make, it would make it so much easier for me to keep my toddler entertained.
I think I know the noise of a dying giraffe from the South Park movie.
Something a little more child appropriate.
Yeah, wah. It's probably not the nicest noise. Oh, if only my husband were here. He does a brilliant impression of that noise. He's much more auditory oriented than I am, and he would just be able to do it brilliantly. No, it's true. It's true. These other things roar and bark and stuff.
That's so right.
Maybe it's a blessing in disguise that you don't have to make that noise a million times.
That's right, perhaps.
So looking forward to the future now, not erasing something from the past, mm-hmm. I am very much hoping that we survive long enough to have spaceships, because they're brilliant.
Obviously.
And I was wondering which feature would be your must-have feature for your own spaceship?
Ooh. Assuming we've got the basics of oxygen and sanitation and so on.
Oh, of course. I mean, goodness, you know, I wouldn't be so cruel as to say you have to name toilets in space as your must-have feature.
I'm very attached to my toilet. I'm not sure. Terribly dull and terribly English as it might sound, could I say a kettle? I don't know where I'd be without my cups of tea, and I'm not just saying this because Tea and Jeopardy tends to be very tea-centric. Mm. But, you know, I see people spruiking pamphlets for religion on street corners, and I think they have a tough time doing that in England, because we're a nation of people that get so much joy and enlightenment from a cup of tea that we really don't need to seek it in any form of higher being. I think it must be particularly hard to try to bring religion to the English masses, because a good cup of tea, and we're probably fine, thanks. So I'll hold out for a kettle on my spaceship, please.
Yes, I couldn't agree with more. Moving on to the Fire Sermon, which is coming out in February, is that right? February?
February in the UK, early March in the US.
Fantastic. Now, the Fire Sermon, my husband has read it, and he said it's very reminiscent of Wyndham and his books, and there's a town called Wyndham in the Fire Sermon. Is that a homage?
It absolutely is, and attentive readers will spot several other little nods to authors who have been particularly influential. Actually, I didn't read John Wyndham's The Chrysalids until after I'd finished the Fire Sermon, but when I did, there were so many things that rung true and that I recognised, so I couldn't resist going back and adding a little nod. And there are a few other place names, both in that and in the sequel, which I'm just about finishing now. I mean, it's always hard to invent names for places, particularly if you're avoiding situating your novel in a known and recognisable place. So every place name has to be new. Mm. And I do find it fun to think of favourite authors or sometimes musicians and whack their names in there. So, yes, Wyndham, the town, is definitely a shout-out to John Wyndham.
Marvellous.
With particular thought to his post-apocalyptic novel, The Chrysalids, which is wonderful.
Which is that your favourite of his, or did you have other favourites before you read that one?
No, that's definitely it. Actually, I'm trying to think whether I've read any of his others. Day of the Triffids, is that him?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, all right. Well, then I have, but Chrysalids is definitely still number one.
One Wyndham novel that is often overlooked is The Kraken Wakes. Have you read that one?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God, you have to read that. Because it's my favourite of his, because often people talk about The Chrysalids and Day of the Triffids and things, but The Kraken Wakes.
Yes, I'll put it on my list.
Yes, put that on your list of books that are too old to be eligible for awards, but that you've just discovered are awesome. Yeah, that is a marvellous book, and not just because it has... actually, I'm not going to say, because I hate spoilers, but I love it. Now, I asked on the Twitters, as I want to do when I am about to receive a friend in the tea there. A friend of mine asked an interesting question. He said the Alpha stroke Omega twins from the Fire Sermon are powerfully evocative. Are they a metaphor for something?
I think yes and no. I mean, on one level, you don't have to go as far as metaphor in the sense that they are what they are, that one very oppressed group and one relatively privileged group is not a stretch of the imagination. We only have to look around at the state of contemporary capitalism and see that that is exactly the society that we've created, in which one group of people benefits from the relative poverty of another group of people. And I don't think that that's necessarily even metaphorical. I think it's cryingly obvious. In another sense, I mean, the sort of more far-fetched or fantastical aspect of my novel, which is that the twins have this fatal bond, and when one of them dies, the other one dies as well, no matter wherever they are. And people have asked me a lot, oh, were you a twin? Where did you get that idea? And although on one hand that idea seems perhaps the most fantastical aspect of the book, that's where I stray into fantasy, or perhaps science fiction, given that it's a mutation that's a result of this long-ago nuclear apocalypse. In other ways, I think that that's the least fantastical and most kind of recognisable aspect of the book, because I think what that has sprung from, the idea of the fatal bond between twins, is just the idea of the bond between people. I mean, I'm sure it's not just me. Perhaps it is because writers tend by nature to be catastrophists. But whenever you've felt very close to someone, and not necessarily a sibling, but, you know, a lover, a parent, anyone that you've loved, you try on that fear of, oh, God, what if they died? How could I even live? Or when you see a friend who suffered a terrible bereavement and you sort of think with great admiration, because in my experience people tend to be incredibly strong and persevere through these things, you sort of think, gosh, how can they live with this loss? How could I live if I lost this person? Margaret Atwood has a tremendous line in one of her poems where the narrator is addressing a lover, and she says something along the lines of, please die so I can write about it. And I think writers do have that slightly morbid imagination, but I think we all do. I think we've all felt that sense of, how could I live without this person? So on one hand, it might seem terribly fantastical, this idea of a fatal bond between twins, but on the other hand, I think it's perhaps the most universal and recognisable aspect of the book, that what we love, we fear losing, and that loss can be devastating, perhaps not in a literal sense of death in our world, but certainly in a very real and pressing sense.
Mm. It's an interesting idea. I've only back in October, my very best friend died, and it does feel like a massive part of me is gone. In the couple of days afterwards, I said to my husband that it felt like part of my face had fallen off.
Yeah.
But I think in some ways it would be kind of kinder if there was this bond where you wouldn't have to have someone left behind.
That's right. I mean, it's a cruelty and a kindness.
Mm.
And what's interesting about the book is that the bond is not seen by everyone necessarily, certainly not seen by the main character in the negative way that it is seen more broadly by the society of the novel. No, I absolutely, I mean, that's really sad news, and I absolutely understand that sense of a profound wrongness in being alive when something as shocking as that has happened to you. It feels like death in a way. And so I think we have all in some way experienced that, just the crushing totality of loss. So that to literally die when you lose your twin is perhaps only one imaginative step further along that path.
Mm. But I think also at the same time there is a sharpening of the brilliance of life. It's a really strange experience that in some ways I have never felt more alive, because I'm very aware that I am left behind. Yeah. And there are so many things to do. There's so much to do. And
right.
It's a very bizarre time. Oh dear, I didn't think I was ever going to talk about this on Team Jeopardy. But it's just how one of those things, you know.
Position, I can only apologise.
No.
This is why I need Woodhouse so much, you see, perhaps because my natural inclinations are towards the gloomy.
Well, no, mine is as well. And as I said, you know, the first novels I wrote are post-apocalyptic, and then I had a short story collection, which is very, very dark. I totally understand writing from those places.
Mm.
And I think also that these are the most important conversations to have. I mean, you know, I am such a fan of frivolity and silliness, especially in the world, my goodness. But I think also being able to be open about the effects of grief, you know,
yeah.
Because there are people who, you know, who listen to this, who knew her. And, you know, if the thought that we can talk about this and be open about it may be a solace to others, then, you know, how wonderful is that?
I hope so.
It's so strange sitting here talking and looking at the brilliant blue sky and thinking of all these sad things. Let's turn to something nicer. I think this is a good time for singing chickens, actually.
Is there ever a bad time for singing?
I'm sure Latimer could come up with an entire list. no, I agree with you. I don't think there is a bad time. So when I have friends over for tea, I like to ask if there is a theme tune that you would choose to express your life, or perhaps a tune that you're particularly fond of, so that we can see if the chickens know it. What would be yours?
Well, I think having grown up in Australia until about 7 years ago, and that's where my family and my husband's family still live, I would very much like to hear the Chickens' version of Men at Work's Land Down Under, please.
Oh, wow, I love that song so much. That is like my childhood, that song. I was obsessed with it when I was about, I don't know how old I was, about 8 or 7 or something. I love that song. So, little chickens, do you know Men at Work's The Land Down Under? Oh, and there they do know it. Well, there we go.
Fantastic.
So there you go. There is your tune, Chickenized.
Thank you very much. Actually, I should have said this in the thing. I don't actually think the novel is particularly depressing, despite being post-apocalyptic. One of my favourite things that someone said on Twitter was that they'd really enjoyed the humour in it, particularly of one character. So I hope that if or when you get round to reading the novel, you won't find it actually grim, despite dealing with, you know, the apocalypse, that old chestnut.
Well, I think one, the other thing as well, culturally, is that sometimes the best humour is in the worst times.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think someone who uses that to fantastic effect is James Moran, who has previously taken tea with us, who writes all sorts of things. But he wrote Severance and Cockneys versus Zombies. Severance is very funny, but we watched Cockneys versus Zombies for the first time a few weeks ago, and it is just fantastic having a zombie apocalypse in an old people's home. And they're all, it's really affectionate kind of both homage and piss take of the kind of the Cockney kind of subculture.
Yeah.
It is actually really quite beautifully funny and poignant at
it's
points.
It's an idea that sells itself, doesn't it? You can just picture the pitch meeting. Yes. You know, Cockney old people's home, zombie apocalypse done.
Stuff yeah. Done. So you've got like, you know, old East End gangsters who have now retired and are in an old people's home and saying, you know, get off him, you soppy tart! You know, all that. It's just wonderful. So, yes, that's thoroughly recommended.
Great.
Well, let me just check that. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty. Oh, that's sad. And we have actually gone through 3 puddings each because this conversation has been so heavy at points.
Yes, well, we needed a bit of pudding consolation.
Yes, yes, absolutely. But may I say thank you for taking the time to come and take tea with us today?
It's an absolute pleasure, and thank you for all the pudding. I didn't realise I'd got through quite so much, but I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's nice to meet someone who matches my levels of pudding consumption, actually. If you would like to cross the dune over there, I believe that the small aircraft that brought you here is waiting to take you back home again.
All right. Well, many thanks for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope to see you again.
Yes, yes. I hope that we'll be able to do this again, and hopefully we'll run into each other this year somewhere or other.
Thank you.
Take care now. Bye.
This way, Mum.
Goodness, I didn't mean to bring up something so personal over tea and pudding.
Can I get you anything, Mum?
No, thank you. I'll be all right. I think... Did you feel that?
No, nothing, Mum. Not even a tremor.
Look, the crumbs are vibrating on the plate.
Oh, I'm very sorry, Mum. I'll clear those away at once.
I'm more concerned by what's causing that. Surely you can feel it now. If I didn't know better, I would think that was worm sign. But of course that's impossible because we're in the Sahara.
Oh no, Mum. We're on Arrakis. The Sahara was already booked.
What the f-
We will be perfectly safe, Mum, as long as we don't move. It's regular movement that calls the worms.
But we're not moving. What could be calling- Oh no, Francesca! What are we going to do?
I'm afraid it's far too late to do anything. But if we keep an eye out, I should be able to recover her P.G. Woodhouse mug. I doubt the worm will digest that.
Latimer! Oh, this really is the limit. I'm going to... But wait, why is she changing her shoes? Oh, she started to climb the nearby rock.
Well, that's not going to do anything.
Oh, it's almost on her. I can't bear to watch.
This is actually the best time for us to return to the plane.
I couldn't possibly.
Don't worry, Mum. I'll come back for the mug later.
She's taken out a book. It's P.G. Woodhouse. I feel quite moved. A final reading before the end.
They paused again. Packy, except for Ooh La La, which he did not quite know how to bring in, had now shot his bolt.
Oh, the worm seems to like it. It sounds a bit like Jabba the Hutt.
No self-respecting invertebrate could resist such wit.
She's like a literary Muad'Dib. It's bowing down.
She's climbing on top of it. I'm afraid both she and the mug are getting away.
Getting away? Don't you mean, thank goodness our friend has avoided certain death in the intestines of a giant worm?
I'll pack our things, ma'am.
While Satomar is packing away, I'd like to announce the winner of the Advent competition. Congratulations and hearty respect is due to Mr. Jeremy Carter, who not only guessed all the films correctly, but also submitted his entry on Christmas Day. Jeremy wins a chickenized version of his favourite song. We will be in touch very soon to see which one that is, Jeremy. Apologies to the other entrants. A few people got the last film wrong, which was The Terminator instead of RoboCop. I, too, would very much like to see Robo Butler. I would also like to raise my teacup to the newest members of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Nick, Bernadette Lewis, Denise Sakuto, and Chris Williamson. Should you wish to join the esteemed order and discover how Latimer became my butler, go to www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy.
Hugo!
Hugo? Oh, Latimer's waving his hands around. I don't know what he means. Oh, Hugo Weaving! Yes, he's a brilliant actor. I loved him in The Matrix, but I did keep expecting Elrond to say Mr. Anderson whenever he appeared. Oh, that's not what you meant.
Hugo's, ma'am.
Hugo's where? Oh, for goodness sake, Latimer, you're not making any sense.
The Hugo Award nominations are now open, ma'am.
Oh, you wanted me to remind people of Tea and Jeopardy's eligibility in the Best Fancast category? Well, why didn't you say so? As our lovely Paul says, we shouldn't be ashamed of such things. I think it's time to go home. Latimer, find us a new location for the tea there, would you? Somewhere with less sand.
Very good, ma'am.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.